sometimes behave so strangely. Hello and welcome to a special conference episode of the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music science. The first full week of November was the 20th meeting of the International Society for Music Information Retrieval, and it happened in Delft in the Netherlands. I was there for my own academic reasons, but I made the time to bring out the microphones and ask some friends at the conference to share their recommendations of things that caught their attention. There were more than 100 projects that were shared at the conference, and there are tons of things that were worthy of being highlighted. This is just a quick sampling. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with ISMIR, this is an annual meeting of people who focus on extracting information from musical signals, things like audio or scores or metadata. And then they try to interpret these for different tasks like beat detection or melody extraction or music recommendation and stuff beyond that still. The focus is often on the design of the systems to translate from input data to conclusions. There's a lot of machine learning techniques that are used, but also some heuristics. And the research is often motivated by industry applications, as well as curiosity and the kind of opportunities that come out of, you know, technological innovation. Now, in the next segment, there will be 7 short recommendations from the conference floor, and then some of my own highlights and resources you might want to take a look at. Now, just a quick note on recording quality. The short interviews were taken in live conference spaces, so be prepared for the kind of jumbled oral experience of poster sessions and the coffee breaks that are shared with 500 other people. So, sorry for that, and otherwise, enjoy. Here we are at the ISMIR poster sessions, which is actually all of the presentations because of the way that ISMIR works. And I'm joined by Matan, who's going to share what he thinks has been an interesting project.
Yes.
Matan, can you introduce yourself first?
Yes, hi Finn. I'm a master's student at McGill University. My supervisor is Philippe Depal. I'm a musician and also a software developer, and I've been working on music tech the last 2 years. And this poster is very interesting for me because it's very related to what I was doing in my thesis. The poster is basically on source separation. So when we have a recording consisting of multiple sound sources.
Like this one right now.
I hope the people can are able to separate my speaking voice from the rest of the background noise. Fortunately, the human brain is very good at doing source separation, but unfortunately, computers are a bit less adept at that.
So this is conditioned UNet, introducing a control mechanism in the UNet for multiple source separation by Gabriel
Messeguer-Brocal
and Geoffrey Peters, and they're from Paris. All right, so what are they doing with this, and how is this innovative, interesting?
Let's first talk about the UNet a bit. The UNet is a way to map from one audio signal to another audio signal, which is basically what we're trying to do in source separation. We have a recording of multiple sound sources, let's say a violin and a flute playing together, but we want to hear only the violin. We have to map between the mixed recording and recording of only one of the sources. In this case, the UNet is very useful because it's shaped like a U. It first maps the signal to a very abstract representation where it kind of has learned concepts which it gradually develops of what this signal contains. So for example, if we have a signal of a violin and a flute, it would gradually process this signal for narrower and narrower using a convolutional neural network, which is a way to learn patterns in the signal in order to extract this higher resolution data.
It would kind of iteratively learn that the texture or the shape of the violin or the flute from the actual source audio and then be better at pulling that particular impression of that, you know, instrument or that source out of the combined recording.
Exactly, that's exactly it. And we use a paradigm called supervised learning, so we need to have a data set of many recordings of violin and flute together, and also for each one of those recordings we need to have matched separate stem recordings of only the flute. So that's pretty hard to get.
Yeah, data set building I'm sure is a big part of this problem.
Exactly. So the actual thing that these people did is combine conditioning into the UNet. So previously, if I wanted to extract violin and flute, I would have to train the UNet one model to extract the flute and one model to extract the violin. But here they managed to train a single model to extract multiple instruments, just by telling it which instrument they want.
Okay. It's a kind of like prepared instruction that's earlier in the process than before, so...
In a way, it's later in the process.
Oh, okay.
Because instead of training a single model for each instrument, they train a single model for all the instruments together, and only at the very end they decide which instrument they want to separate.
Okay.
All right. And that's, I would say that's, in general, something that people are discussing a lot here is how to condition neural networks.
Right. Yeah.
So this fits into this general theme.
Cool. So is the performance better? Like, what convinces you that this is a big step forward?
What is interesting is to look at the number of parameters that they use. We can see that a fixed unit, so if we have the original model that they are comparing to, we have almost 10 million parameters per model. And if we want to separate four instruments together, then we actually need 40 million parameters.
Wow.
So what they did is instead use only 10 million parameters, but achieve the same performance. So basically, we're doing the same thing, but doing it with much lighter performance penalty.
Right.
Less memory and less training time and less running time.
Cool.
So it's not like, oh, we have something that works much better, but we have something that is easier to train, it's faster and lighter, which is a great thing because it shows that the model was actually able to extract higher level representations that are relevant to the violin and the flute together and share these parameters.
Yeah, as opposed to only treating one at a time.
Exactly, and that is a little bit like the human brain. We would say we would like to imagine, we have no idea obviously, but we would like to imagine that in our brain we have shared concepts between flute and violin and are able to employ our knowledge about flutes and violins to also the human voice and stuff like that. So everything is kind of shared, but we have no idea how.
Yeah.
And that's what they were probably trying to do. They were probably saying to themselves, it makes sense that if we train a single model, then it would work well. But what if we want to share the knowledge? And, well, they showed that it worked, so this is encouraging.
Nice. All right. Well, bravo for them, and thank you for explaining this project and why you think it's interesting.
Thank you, Finn.
I'm here with Rachel Bittner. Rachel, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, Finn. I'm Rachel Bittner. I'm a research scientist at Spotify, and I just came from NYU, finished my PhD a couple years ago.
Yeah. We studied together, so.
Yes.
Good times. All right, so what do you recommend this ISMIR?
I recommend a paper by Guillaume Doras and Geoffroy Peters called Cover Detection Using Dominant Melody Embeddings.
Mm.
So the project is about identifying cover songs in a large database, which is important for Spotify, as you might imagine.
Yes.
And what I really liked about the paper was that most cover song papers assume that covers are defined by chord changes, which I don't actually think is the right, that's exploiting a correlation instead of trying to find the thing that defines a cover.
Right, yeah.
So what I really like about this paper is it uses melody as the basis for determining what's a cover.
Right. Now, melody, I'm assuming, hasn't often been used because it's been hard to get melody out.
Yes.
So what are they doing to extract that?
So what I also like about this is it doesn't use strictly defined melody outputs, like a time series of the melody. It uses the probability distribution over pitches likely to be in the melody. So it's using actually a matrix, a salience matrix of the melody as the input to the model. So that allows it to not be so dependent on or suffering from mistakes from the earlier model.
Right, yeah. So it takes advantage of some of those things and also makes a little bit of space for, well, I remember from their demo, it seemed like that it was really good for getting at covers that crossed genre boundaries, which was fascinating.
Exactly.
Yeah, really, really impressive. Where do you expect this to lead to? What kind of work does this continue on towards?
So I think there's a really interesting extension, which I think the authors have been looking into. Another dimension that defines a cover is lyrics, because two songs can share the same lyrics but have different melodies.
For sure,
and still be covers. So I think a very similar approach could be applied to where they're using some kind of soft lyric input.
Nice, yeah. So still allowing there to be kind of a probabilistic flexibility
too, while still recognizing lyric information.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So as opposed to getting stuck on really good source separation and all of that
or
stuff.
Or good lyric transcription.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, and being able to separate out these things, mm-hmm. it's leveraging the shape of the information around the flexibilities and actually getting good connections.
Exactly.
Yeah, I really wonder what kind of errors they're getting.
Yeah, I would be interested to talk to the authors and find that out.
Yeah. Do you know if they're releasing like a data set with this, or are they releasing the code itself?
Yeah, they released the code and they created a data set to build their model in the first place.
Right, yeah.
And I believe they also released the data set. It's on YouTube IDs, as many data sets now are.
Okay.
But I think it's quite large, like in the tens of thousands.
Amazing.
So it's really really useful, nice data set.
And that then it's the kind of a thing that can be turned backwards where we can then also study
melody similarity.
For example, I wonder why you would care about that. Yes. That right. We're joking about it because your dissertation was on melody. So yeah, no, that would be a great way to get good information to mm-hmm. move that even further along.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Well, thank you
for
this recommendation. Surprise, surprise. In Delft, we've come across Andrew Dimitriou, who you might remember from a previous episode. Anyway, you're part of the organization team here, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I was Fringe Chair this year.
Yeah.
So I got to organize a lot of events that are not directly related to the scientific program here. Mm-hmm. So things like the different kinds of jam sessions around town primarily. Uh-huh. And probably the one I'm the most proud of is the Wimmer Workshop, which was a really big success. So we're really happy about that.
No, it's been a great time. We're all exhausted for very good reason. And I think you are very much to blame for a lot of that fatigue. All right. But you've also been paying attention to what's happening here, you know, the science side of things,
the research side.
So you found a project that really caught your interest.
Definitely. So I'm looking at the project that was presented by Jinha Lee. Mm-hmm. It's a paper that she wrote with her colleagues, who I haven't met personally, Liz Pritchard and Chris Hubbles.
Can we listen to it together? Factors influencing reception of music recommendations and post-recommendation behavior. So this was a user study that was asking people to talk about why they liked listening to things when recommended by people and when recommended by automated systems, algorithms.
Yeah. My lab members and I were talking about it, I think, a good amount for a couple of different reasons. Well, the specific thing that we ended up focusing on was she asked what specific things about the recommendation somebody might not like.
Yeah.
Okay, so they delved, I think, a layer deeper than just whether or not somebody liked the recommendation. Yes, it was also why. Yeah. What about it didn't you like?
Yeah. Really rich data.
It was really rich data. So it was started with a qualitative study, and I thought this was super cool. So they did grounded theory analysis. It's just a way of coding, adding labels to different kinds of qualitative data. Mm-hmm. And you can apply it in a bunch of different ways. But they did it with multiple coders, which was really cool.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
So I talked to her about it yesterday. She said, I mean, it took them over a year. So this is a very painstaking process, but it's a very rich process. So you get to pull all sorts of things out of the data. So I thought that was really cool and a very rich way to look at a problem like this. But the thing that we were talking about a lot in my lab were the reasons why you might reject a recommendation. So there might be things about the lyrics that don't gel with you for one reason or another. If you have certain values, if I'm very much a feminist, for example, I might find the rap lyrics to be really, really, really offensive. But we don't see that a lot in recommendation systems being taken into account. At least I haven't come across it very often.
Another thing that I noticed when this was being presented was that when people were recommended music by friends or people they knew, they would listen to it. They would just give it a chance in a way that they wouldn't necessarily do for something that was recommended algorithmically. So there was like a different, like they had a reason to listen to it when it was coming from someone that they knew versus not. And another factor that I think is sort of something that hasn't been seen a lot of in this kind of work before was that they got people talking about how sort of the social values of the artist actually mattered to what they wanted to listen to, which was a fascinating point. I mean, we kind of expect that, right? The conversation has been so much of late, like on social media and so on, about like, should we continue to support artists when we find out that they're very problematic? And, you know, how do we incorporate those identities into the art that we love? And that includes music, very much so. And they were getting reflections of that conversation in the data that they collected, with people saying, I don't want to listen to this. It was recommended, but I don't want to listen because I know more about the context of the work. I know more about the artist, or I know something about the artist. Those social aspects of the creation of works and the context of works are informing people's listening choices as well.
And I love that it was able to emerge in this way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think...
Really ground up.
And so sometimes looking at data in this qualitative way, mm-hmm. where you have this really rich data set that you just dig into for a year,
yeah.
you'll get a bunch of insights or even ways of phrasing these insights that mm-hmm. we might not be all that familiar with.
For sure, for sure.
And so I thought the question about values was particularly interesting as well. Yeah, definitely, right?
Yes. No, yeah. It's a really cool project. Well, thank you for highlighting it, and I hope people check it out. The link
yeah,
will be in the
I
show
hope
notes.
So too.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, good to see
thank
you.
Thank you. Yeah, good to see you too. Nice to meet in person.
Yeah, definitely.
Hi, my name is Felicia. I'm a graduate of Smith College here at Izmir, and I'm recommending the paper Samba Set, a data set of historical Samba de Jado recordings for computational music analysis. The authors are Lucas Maya, Magdalena Fuentes, Luis Vizcaíno, Martin Rocamora, and Slim Esid. And this paper is about the very first large data set of Samba de Jado recordings and how this was gathered by compiling 493 sambas in 486 different audio tracks from three major collections from different styles of samba.
I'm Ashley Burgoyne. I'm an assistant professor in computational musicology at the University of Amsterdam. And although you wouldn't know it from my title, I'm actually mostly a member of the Music Cognition Group. And my work these days sits between this space of MIR and music cognition. One of the music cognition experiments I did recently involves a large international game experiment using mostly British English language pop music. And when we looked at the Google Analytics, we had a few participants from almost every country in the world. But the non-English speaking country that participated the most was Brazil. And ever since that time, I've been dreaming of doing a new version of this experiment in Brazil, using a mix of music from the original experiment and something with local flavor. Brazil is the perfect music culture, in my opinion, for this, because it has such a strong and wonderful music culture of its own, while also being very familiar to some extent with the international pop music I was using before. I'd always struggled to find what's the right data set, what's the right group to work with, and when I saw this paper, I thought, maybe I found it.
Samba is a very important part of Brazilian culture and the Brazilian national narrative, just based on what I've studied, and it has very traceable ties to the Afro-Brazilian diaspora and different religious practices of that culture. It's very important in their national narrative, and as well as the image they portray to the rest of the world. It influences tourism and culture and just many different parts of Brazil's image. Samba de Jado is particularly associated with the annual Carnaval celebration, and it's very unique because in this celebration it's actually a parade and different samba schools play different songs, different styles, and it's a very festive atmosphere, and it's outdoors. So there's in the study they speak about how that kind of context that it's played in really affected some of the track tempo that they analyzed from the data set that they created.
So Ashley, you're interested in music and memory, and this is a kind of music that has strong sort of ties to specific groups and specific communities. People know, you know, tunes in a sense, know specific samba works. And so this is an opportunity for you to get into that somewhat, do you think?
Exactly. That was one of the things that I was most excited to hear when I was speaking with the authors about the project. So in my earlier work, one issue that you have sometimes, there are ways of working around it, but the British pop music from the 1940s isn't necessarily all that well known by most people listening to music today. With samba, that isn't necessarily the case. There are classics going all the way back to the 1940s that are still remade and are still very well known in this context. Not everything, and that's also important if you want to do cognition research. Some songs have been forgotten, others haven't been. And some of that's going to be coincidence, but what I'm very curious to know is if some of it might have to do with the music itself. And again, with a large data set like this, it's a beautiful opportunity to investigate that. Are the aspects that are responsible for long-term musical memory in a European pop music context the same in a very different musical context?
It's also interesting because samba is very associated with a dance, like a very
yes.
specific one. So
people have rich, like, embodied relationships with this.
Definitely.
It's not just a thing they heard playing on the radio. They, mm-hmm. you know, a Brazilian population at least would have an awareness of that. Yeah. That would be part of how they remember it, is, you know.
And a tie to a dance or like a live performance they've seen, because it's super popular. So. Yeah.
And especially given that this data set is annotated with beats, that's the other thing that makes it so special. So a lot of the work I've done before, you have to work with what you have. Mm-hmm. Here we have actually very good beat information. So if you want to study something about the rhythm, which is often very difficult to do in a cognition context, it's perfect.
Yeah. All right. Well, it sounds like a great data set, and I'm so glad we had the chance to recommend it. So thank you both for participating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and I'm here during the lunch break with Nestor.
Yes, I'm Nestor Napoles Lopez. I'm a PhD student at McGill University.
Mm-hmm. We work with each other back in Montreal.
Attending Izmir for the second time this year.
It's been a good show, hasn't it?
Yes, very different from last year, at least from my perspective, but very nice.
So you're recommending one of the 20th anniversary papers. So this is the 20th anniversary of Izmir. And so besides the usual general work, there's been a bunch of review papers that were prepared specifically to give us kind of like an overview of how different topics have developed.
I was very interested in this paper called 20 Years of Automatic Chord Recognition from Audio, presented by Johan Pauwels with three co-authors. And I don't think I was specifically trying to pay more attention to the anniversary papers than other papers, but in particular I thought this was very relevant for the things that I'm researching, the things that I've seen, and it was a very nice survey that summarized everything that it's going on with this task for a long time.
So one of the things the paper did was describe, as opposed to just listing like the chronology of work, it discussed specific problems and challenges for chord recognition, which is a really nice way of organizing this kind of review.
Yes, so I think it's very nice that the paper introduced the problem itself, because sometimes we even give for granted that, you know, we are finding chords, but what does that mean?
And
this paper introduces that, how people have defined the problem, and how the solution for the problem is also defined, the evaluation, all of the things that implies, like ambiguity and multiple labels for the same fragment, which I think is something that happens a lot in not only that task, but many tasks of music information retrieval. So all of that stuff for me was very interesting. And you don't often see that kind of survey, in-depth analysis of the tasks, and I really like that.
You've been following, researching this area, I think, as part of your comprehensive exams, too, so it's very much on theme. Were there any things that they referred to that surprised you that you hadn't been aware of before?
There was something that caught my attention more than everything else, and it was the feature. The feature that seems to be prevailing after many years in MIR, and specifically in tasks that are related with tonality, key detection, chord detection, and that's the chromograms, and also known as chroma features, HPCP, and other names that they have had through the years. So this is part of my comprehensive, so I had to go and make a similar survey of for key, not for chords. Mostly we have assumed that these features are the best way of tackling the problem and the best input for trying to find these high-level abstractions in music. And it was very interesting to see that in the presentation as well, to see that I think there's another thing that can be used, the tonal centroid, but it's much, much less used than chroma features. And after 20 years, we're basically using the same thing. And after the presentation, I went to talk to Johan Pauwels to discuss this further, because I don't know if it's in the interest of the MIR community to search for other ways of extracting this information than the chromogram features. And we were just discussing about that.
There was another paper here. I forget the details of it, but one of the qualities that it was considering was the representing of sort of harmonic information in chromograms, which are register neutral, right? It brings, basically, it's like a pitch class representation of what sort of pitches are present, wrapping the energy together into one 12-part, a vector of 12.
And in this particular study, they found that allowing register information to be included, so allowing that sort of energy weighting to be within different areas of the frequency range, added some important information that was lost when it was reduced to chroma. Now, I mean, that was a particular, you know, task that was in a particular corpus. And obviously, chord recognition has mostly used the chromogram because it has mostly been advantageous. But there is still information lost that maybe is relevant in other representations may be called for, particularly for different genres, maybe, that have different arrangement of harmonic information. So, yeah, no, it's good to see that 20 years later, while the chromogram is still important, there is reason to continue to think about this problem. Because as they said, and as you can attest, this isn't solved.
Yes. Yes, I think there are multiple fronts that we could address in this problem. Like, evaluation is a huge problem. People must pay attention to different ways, new ways of evaluating these sort of algorithms and the output, interpreting the output that they provide. Because sometimes we're really trying to find a label. I was discussing that with Itch, actually, Ichiro Fujinaga, my supervisor. I call him Itch because...
We all call him Itch.
Yes. So, about how these different labels could be really the same thing, but how do we measure the distance between them and say, oh, you know, if you're calling this thing like G major with the sixth or something like that, that's very similar to other labels that are actually in space very close to each other. And yeah, so that's one front, but other fronts could be the features that we use to solve these problems, that the mapping between what we in music information retrieval obtain and comparison to what musicologists and what people who know about music theory think of when they analyze the score
or composers as they're, or musicians as they're using these things. And yeah.
Yes. So yeah. I think all of that stuff is encompassed in this paper. That's why I like it so much.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for making that recommendation.
Thank you.
So I'm here with Tidja Sweeney to talk about a project that she recommends. Oh, this one. Yes. Okay. I'm very excited to talk about this. Okay. Well, first, can you introduce yourself?
My name is Tidja Sweeney. I am just finishing my PhD from the University of Oslo, and I work with melodic perception and embodiment, so motion capture and music information.
So this is Estimating Unobserved Audio Features from Target-Based Orchestration by John Gillick, Carmen Emanuel Cello, and David Baman.
This project is about mapping some sounds to other sounds is the easiest way to describe it. And I got drawn to this project because their presentation was full of examples, which made it really accessible for people to understand what the motivations were. And I also really appreciated the fact that the motivations were creative while the methods were more, should I say, miry?
Yes, yeah.
Mired.
Yes.
And so the concept is that if you have the sound of a chicken, but you also have a database of 20,000 orchestral sounds that have their own musical characteristics, then how do you find a or several combinations of sounds from the 20,000 orchestral sounds that most resemble the chicken sound? And it's a really exciting problem, not just in order to make orchestral sounds of chickens, but also I'm reminded of some spectral composition work, which resonated with this kind of an idea where you used a whole orchestra, for example, to create the sound of a trombone or a saxophone and so on. So that is really exciting. I really like the fact that it has a compositional and creative element to it, which a lot of people can use for setting up actual musical content and not just get, you know, networky. But also the fact that their methods are really interesting. So this uses several mixture models, but only energy-weighted FFT and MFCC, and then tries to see how many mixtures it would take in for some MLPs and other models to perform above baseline in order to create sound. So I also really like the fact that such a project could have had its kind of proof of concept, of proof of the pudding in user evaluations, where you ask people if they agreed that the sound of chickens was being made. But instead, they have a very concrete kind of methodology for evaluating this automatic system as well.
Yeah.
So these are the reasons that I think this work is very, very cool. And I think that it could be useful in a large number of domains. Mm-hmm. I also really like the fact that each of the 20,000 samples is taken to be its own. So a violin plays piano, but it's not a violin sound that has low amplitude. It is a piano
version
of violence. So those are some of the things that I like.
Yeah. So what I found really great about, like, you know, there's a car horn example that John presented, and it had that sort of clanging sound, a really good representation of the harmonic qualities. Like, it was really right there with the pitch values that you could hear in those intervals. Yeah. And then what was fantastic about the chicken or the rooster example is that it had, like, all of these, like, multiple entries for what ends up, like, we recognize, oh, that's one animal crowing, but it reconstructed it in this really cool way. And so to have, like, that, those temporal qualities as well as just a, like, spectral representation mush, you know, the output's really cool. So it was a great presentation of what this does. There's a really good validation of, like, how efficient their model is, and it's a max patch, and so people can actually download this and play with it themselves. Yeah, so if people go to carmenselleck.com/orcidea, there'll be a link in the show notes, don't worry. You can actually, like, download this and play with this yourself. So really fun work. So, well, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you for asking me.
I've run into Brian McPhee, which is completely normal because he's been coming here for, oh, is that 12 years now?
This is number 12.
Number 12, your 12th round here. Yeah, so you really know what this community does and what's going on here. Now, you are recommending a project that seems to be quite relevant to this sort of long-term survival of this community by Meinhard Mueller and Frank Zelko, called the FMP Notebooks.
Yeah, so this project is a collection of educational materials for learning about music information retrieval. It's connected to Meinhard's book, Fundamentals of Music Processing. The book is an excellent reference and a good way to learn about signal processing, and it covers all the kind of basics of music information retrieval, how signal processing works, how we think about the problems that we approach in this field, and some kind of classical methods for solving these problems. But at the end of the day, it is a book. And you read through it and you see a lot of equations. And you see descriptions of problems, but you don't really have data. And you, if you want to play with it, you have to re-implement things. So what they've done here is try to make this more interactive. So they've re-implemented a bunch of methods in self-contained IPython notebooks that you can download and run at your own leisure.
What is an IPython notebook?
That is a great question. So an IPython notebook is a self-contained document that contains a mixture of code, text, images, perhaps interactive media, other things that you display in a web browser. And it allows you to execute Python code and interact with it and then change things and run it again and see how results change. And
I find that's really helpful to, like, to script. So, like, I will write a bit of code and I will see what comes out, and then I can do the adjustments there, and then I can keep those all together so I can do a long script with the capacity to do, like, minor adjustments and see things. And I mean, in this case, even, like, play music examples that are with these music information retrieval, whatever manipulations that are there being explained.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's also great because you can embed text and images alongside your code and actually explain what's going on. Which is great for educational purposes.
Yeah, it's just all in one package.
So
this is multiple chapters. It starts with the basics of, like, hey, how to code in Python, which, I mean, if someone needs to understand that first, it's right there. They have an introductory page. It gives some overview of, like, the fundamentals of music processing. So this is all stuff that, like, MIR basically takes for granted. If you're going to be reading MIR, these are ideas we all kind of assume we all already understand.
Things like digital signals, MIDI, what is a wave, what is pitch,
That
sort of thing.
and the way that like they think about, this community thinks about, I shouldn't say they, this community thinks about like structure and chords and beat tracking and, you know, which isn't the same in all music studies. So it gives a good overview of these things with a chance to like practice and develop intuition for this stuff, as well as actually just see all the details of fairly well explained, you know, material.
That's right. And there's data that comes with this. So they implement a method, they have some basic data, you can run the method over that data, see the results, and see how to evaluate the method and interpret the results. And then you can play with the parameters of each, say, beat tracker. You can change your window tolerances, you can change your tempo ranges, and then you can listen to the results. You can put a click track down on top of your input audio and listen to it directly in the browser.
Right, to see if the beats line up with...
And then you can iterate on that, and it makes it very interactive and has kind of a much shorter loop in between what you change and what you see as a result of your change, which is how you learn.
Yes. And you get to see also how these great visualizations are produced, because it's in the code itself, you know, which is really helpful when we're trying to figure out how to convey this kind of information. Yeah. What a great collection.
It is super cool. Nice job, Meinert and Frank.
Thank you. And I'm guessing if it's just out there, it's to download for free. That's the like the idea, right?
Yep,
it's open source.
There is a website and a QR code on the poster, which I guess we can attach to this somehow.
Yes, yeah. In the show notes, there'll be a link to the paper, which will include all the same information. So, yeah, so people that are interested in getting a sense of music information retrieval or trying to, you know, understand one piece of it or even just learning to code for music stuff, this is actually a really good resource for people to pick up. So, all right, well, thank you for recommending this.
Yeah, happy to.
My thanks to Rachel Bittner, Ashley Burgoyne, Andrew Demetrio, Matan Gover, Tijaswini Kelker, Brian McPhee, Nestor Napolis-Lopez, and Felicia Villalobos for taking a moment out of their conference experience to share some suggestions for you all. Now, a few of my own faves. Okay, so first off, the AIST dance video database. Multi-genre, multi-dancer, multi-camera database for dance information processing by Chuhei Tsushida, Satoru Fukuyama, Masahiro Hamasaki, and Masataka Goto. And this is a really awesome database of multi-camera recordings of urban dance. And the urban dance performances that they have are solo dance performances, group choreographies of different numbers of dancers, and even battles for a total of like 30 hours of dancing. So the setup is wild because it is capturing things from many angles. And I really hope gesture and dance researchers take proper advantage of this new resource. I think it's super exciting. It's a dance form that I really find fascinating. And this is just a huge amount of work to prepare this kind of thing, and there's a lot of information to be found. So yay, go them. The keynotes were also great at Izmir, and two stand out in particular. Anyone who's new to questions about like whether other animals are musically inclined or what animal musicality might say about our musicality, they should really check out Henkin Honing's excellent lecture, What Makes Us Musical Animals. It's a nice introduction to ideas that have been all over music cognition for a while, but are relevant well beyond. And the other keynote I want to point to is Georgina Bourne's critical look at MIR practices in MIR Redux, Knowledge in Real World Challenges, and New Interdisciplinary Futures. It's a very interesting take on many technological and cultural biases that inform the music information research area, and a really cool humanities twist that took some participants by surprise. Both of these lectures are open and available to watch online. There are links in the show notes. Do not hesitate. And lastly, anyone who's interested in finding out more about MIR research or maybe following up on the types of resources that are suggested by the many different things that were recommended here should really check out the Izmir Explorer, a visual interface for exploring 20 years of Izmir publications by Thomas Lowe, Christian Henschel, Sayantan Pauli, Anastab Das, Harold Sack, Andrea Nussberg, and Sebastian Stober. Now, the Izmir conference is like the premier place to publish for MIR research, and they've taken all of the papers that they could find in the last 20 years, scraped their contents, and present you this explorer that lets you query topics and actually see related papers organized graphically by color and distance. So, you know, you can put in a query search about like motion and you see a bunch of things that are directly related to motion, but then also organized by sort of how their own content relates to each other. And you can click through and explore and find things from recent years and past years that might be related to the research that you're trying to conduct now. It makes browsing very, very easy. And I hear that an update is going to be arriving soon in the new year that will add this year's papers to the already substantial pile already made available on the platform. So that's the Izmir Explorer. Again, link in the show notes. That's all the Izmir content for now. If you liked the live interview format, I might be able to do it again in the future, and maybe even with tighter microphones. And as always, if you're a researcher in music science and you'd like to recommend a recent paper you found, get in touch at sostrangely.com/contact or by email, finn@sostrangely.com. And until next time, keep looking into why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behave so strangely. Sometimes behave so strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely.